everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net. Scary movie love for scary movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I could not be more excited about this very special episode because I get to talk about The Beyond with the co-writer and director of one of, if not my very favorite, horror movies this year. Beyond the Gates, which is coming out, I believe, in December. Mr. Jackson Stewart, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for the kind words, and thank you for having me on. Sorry to interrupt you also by saying it's coming out in December.
You were merely fact-checking. Do we have an exact date?
We do. I guess I can probably drop it now. It's December 9th. It'll be out on VOD and theatrical. We're nailing down the exact cities. It should be about 5 cities, New York, LA, and then a handful of other ones. But it'll be out on VOD that day, and it should be a lot of fun.
Very, very cool. And that's coming out through IFC Midnight?
Yes, sir.
That's very exciting, because then that means it will also be a Scream Factory Blu-ray, correct?
Yeah, this is actually a funny aside, and I've been hoping I'd be able to tell this at some point, but the guy who is producing the DVD and Blu-ray, my friend Hank Weintraub, actually used to work with him in a video store up in Eugene, Oregon, and so it's really kind of come full circle for what the story of this movie was about. So it's really cool, and I'm super excited that they're putting it out, because they're pretty much my favorite DVD Blu-ray company right now.
Yeah, mine too. And then to have this movie, which I saw back at the Bruce Campbell Horror Film Festival in August, and you were there, and several of the stars were there, Chase Williamson and Bria Grant and Barbara Crampton. I just fell in love with the movie. I'm not going to try to like make you uncomfortable by sucking off your movie, but I've thought about it so much since, and really was such a fan, so thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to hear that. Kind of the intent of it was hopefully this would be the type of movie where you could rewatch it as the years go on. My favorite movies are always like the ones where you just kind of keep going back to them over the years. Like As Weird As It Sounds, I think probably my favorite movie of 2013 was This Is the End, because I just kept being able to watch it because it had all these cool horror elements in it. And I thought it was hilarious also, but those kinds of movies where they're just infinitely rewatchable, which I'm not saying mine is, I hope it is, but yeah, thank you very much for the kind words on that.
Yeah. It's like, This Is the End. It's the kind of movie where you just want to, for me at least, you want to keep spending time in this world and hanging out with these people, you know, and that's kind of what brings you back to it over and over again. That's why I've been thinking about it. So thank you.
You're quite welcome.
So we are going to talk about The Beyond later, which I'm crazy excited about, because I think each of us just saw it screened recently, but we'll talk about that. But first, I will ask you the question that I always ask the guest on the show, which is, have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, I saw a very weird Joseph Zito film that I'd actually never heard of called Abduction, which is basically like a riff on him, on the Patty Hearst kidnapping. It's basically a Patty Hearst exploitation movie, but it's done in this very, you know, kind of upsetting way, which I have a lot of respect for the movies of the 70s that can just make you actively uncomfortable throughout the duration of it. And it's pretty interesting to see what he was doing before, you know, Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter, and The Prowler, and Invasion USA. I think Joseph Zito is a really underrated director. So I thought that movie was really cool. I have no idea if it has ever come out on any home video format. I saw it at the New Beverly on a double feature with another movie that I'm spacing. But yeah, I thought that was absolutely terrific. And then I also saw Uncle Kent 2 with Kent Osborne, who is one of the, I think he's one of the showrunners on Adventure Time or something. I'd never seen Uncle Kent 1, the Joe Swanberg movie, but this one is directed by Todd Rohall, who did The Cataclysm, which is one of my favorite movies of recent years. If you haven't seen it, it's absolutely hilarious. It's completely bizarre and just a total thrill to watch from front to back. But Uncle Kent 2 was super weird. It's a really good antidote for a lot of the boring tentpole movies that have come out this summer, and I think people would be very wise to check it out on VOD formats.
Okay. I'm looking. I haven't seen Uncle Kent 1, and I pulled up Uncle Kent 2's IMDb page because I don't think I realized that they had made an Uncle Kent 2. The poster looks exactly like a mid-90s thriller.
Yeah.
Is that just the poster, or is that something they're going for in the movie?
The movie's nothing like that, but they're very conscious of how they're presenting that movie. It's a hilarious movie that's very much in line with this sort of movie he's trying to tell within it.
Okay.
Because basically the entire premise of this movie is him trying to convince Joe Swanberg to make a sequel to Uncle Ken, and Swanberg has utterly no interest in doing it. And so it's very, very funny. So I highly recommend that.
I'm in, man. I enjoy Joe Swanberg's movies. Sometimes I enjoy him even more as an actor.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, he's really, really good. Every time I see him show up in something, I get excited. He pops in for one scene in like Joshi, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, and he's hilarious. He and his wife show up for one scene and kind of steal the whole thing. But
yeah, he's a super nice guy too. I have a lot of respect for him. Like not every one of his movies has landed with me, but I think he's a really talented guy, and I have a ton of respect for him.
Yeah, right on. All right, so let's talk about The Beyond, because I had asked you if you would be willing to come on the show during October, and you very graciously accepted. And then I was like, all right, what movie would you like to talk about? And you said The Beyond, and I said, yes. But what was it that kind of that led you to choose The Beyond?
You know, I mean, it's really interesting, because I think for quite a number of years, it didn't really get the attention that it deserved. And I think more recently it has, probably, over the past 5 or 6 years. But I saw this movie when I was 16, and I just remember being so like grossed out and troubled by it in a very unique way. There's something about the violence that like Lucio Fulci does in his movie that is like, it's very stomach turning, and it's like spiritually upsetting, I think, because it's like so much of his violence just like absolutely dehumanizes people, where it like just like disfigures them horribly. The opening of the movie is these townspeople going after a warlock and hitting him in the face with like a chain and just like brutally murdering him. And it's, I mean, you're watching, you're just like, God, this is so ugly. But that coupled with the crazy Italian dubbing where they're, like, you ungodly warlock and all that stuff, you're just like, what is this crazy effect that this movie is having? Because it's just working in all these different areas that I think is really interesting. But, it's one of these things I saw early on. I was like, okay, that was cool. And then I just kind of kept finding myself coming back to it over and over through the years. Like, there's so many things in it that are just permanently burned into my brain that I feel like it would be worth talking about with you. So that was the main idea there.
It is absolutely worth talking about. I have such a weird relationship with really all of Italian horror, and people listening to this have probably heard the story, but for years, I kept trying. I would see something by Fulci or Argento or whatever, and I would be like, I just don't get it. Like, it's not making sense to me. And because I am kind of a story and character guy, I think, or at least I was. I think I've gotten so much better at kind of abstract stuff. But I just couldn't wrap my head around it. And yet, I kept being drawn back to it. You know, it wasn't like I saw two movies and I was like, nope, not for me, and walked away. I kept trying and rewatching stuff and checking out new stuff. And it wasn't until probably 2 or 3 years ago, and oddly enough, the movie where it all clicked into place for me was The New York Ripper.
Oh, God, I love that one.
Yeah, but, like, that shouldn't be the movie where I'm like, oh, I get it. And all of a sudden, I was all in, and I just kept, like, I was going back and rewatching stuff and just consuming everything I could and kind of rabidly trying to read about all these filmmakers and make all the connections between all their movies. So I was seeing, you know, I had seen a couple of Fulci movies during like the 2 a.m. slot at some of these 24-hour horror marathons that I would to. And it was rough.
What a time to watch this.
Right. On the one hand, it's like the worst time. On the other hand, it's like, oh, that's the only time to watch it.
Yeah.
So it had kind of left me cold. And so I've since gone back and really kind of fallen for all of his movies. But I had not seen The Beyond until a couple years ago. So I never saw like all of the butchered versions. You know, there were all these versions that were out with like stuff taken out, violence taken out, story taken out. So I really have only ever seen the full restoration that Grindhouse did.
Yeah.
And it is, I think, as of right now, I would say it's my favorite Fulci movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's hands down my favorite of his, like by a country mile. You know, I mean, there's other stuff of his I really like. The Gates of Hell is pretty brilliant. Actually, House by the Cemetery is a pretty close second. But yeah, I'm in full agreement. I first came to it, I think, on a Anchor Bay VHS tape, like back in 2002, maybe, or 2001, or it might have even, it maybe was a DVD. I'm not entirely sure. But, you know, Grindhouse, I think, got a hold of it in 2008 or something. But, yeah, I haven't seen the Seven Doorways of Death or whatever the I think that's the original title for what it was in the U.S. But I'd never seen that version, and this one is absolutely my favorite Fulci film. House by the Cemetery definitely has a lot of its own charms and cool atmosphere, but I also think too the final, you know, 2 minutes of The Beyond is like some of the best stuff I've ever seen in any movie ever, period. You know, like when they're walking through that, you know, the purgatory dimension or whatever, the first time I saw that, I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. I was like, what the fuck did they do in here? Like, I couldn't wrap my head around it. It was like, it really just transports you into this other world. And I think it's really, you know, I guess where I'm getting a little ahead of myself with it, but yeah, I'm totally with you.
So I'm interested from a filmmaker perspective, because I hear both sides when it comes to Fulci. I hear that he's a bad director, that he's clumsy, and that his movies are kind of clunky and kind of almost hacky. And then I hear the other side, which is like, no, he's actually a terrific technician and formalist. And in The Beyond, I think I see it more than in a lot of his other movies, because as you're talking about, even that last sequence is so striking and so beautiful that I think only, you know, a visionary filmmaker could kind of pull that off. But where do you kind of land in terms of his style or his approach to filmmaking?
I mean, I think he's an absolute genius. His sense of authorship is pretty apparent throughout every movie he's done. You know, I mean, granted, I haven't seen like White Fang and his like 60s sex comedies and stuff, but as far as his horror stuff, if you watch one of those movies, you can tell it came from him. And that is always like the work of a true craftsman, I feel like. So, I mean, it kind of bums me out to hear that people think he's like clunky or whatever, because his stuff is, you know, I think the stories may be a little messy or like might have some problems in them, you know, or like there might be things that maybe don't make sense. And, you know, okay, I think people could make the argument that the gore and some of the effects in those movies looks a little dated, which I don't agree with. But, you know, it's like at the time he was doing that, he was a real trailblazer. Like no one was doing violence like that in movies. You know, there was Herschel Gordon Lewis and stuff, but it's basically like he would go down to the grocery store and grab like, you know, some cow innards or whatever and like put some red paint on them. You know, it's like it's nowhere near what Fulci was trying to do. And I think, you know, there's varying degrees of effectiveness with that stuff. But he was a real trailblazer, dude. Like if you watch, you know, that little girl getting her head blown off, you're like, that's insane. Like, when did you see anything like that before that? You know, I mean, it's like there's Dawn of the Dead. But I mean, if you stack those two head explosions next to each other, it's like the Beyond is way better. You know, I mean, like, I think Dawn of the Dead's a better movie. But, you know, the head in Dawn of the Dead just looks like it's made of paper mache and it explodes and it's awesome. And, you know, we all love that. But the thing in the Beyond is like it basically it's like cut together in a way where it does feel like that little girl is getting her fucking head blown off. And it's awesome.
The gore stuff is weird because, you know, that was the entry point for me again during those years where I was like, I don't get it, man. What I was hearing around me was everyone was just like, yeah, Fulci gore, eyeball trauma, you know? And I was like, okay, I get it, but like, And now I watch it, and, you know, as a horror movie fan, I like that shit. I like gore or whatever, but, and I totally agree that he was pushing it in a way that other filmmakers, I don't feel like even any filmmaker since does it in the same way, where it's almost like this movie's going to stop cold to show you something completely gnarly, and then we'll resume. As gross as it is, I think the thing that I respond to, whether it's the two sequences that really come to mind are the spider attack in The Beyond the throwing up the guts in Gates of Hell.
Where and it's also The Beyond too. They kind of do that. And that guy in the basement is puking his own guts.
Oh yeah. Right.
I mean, not to the same, I don't think it's quite as lurid as it is in Gates of Hell, but yeah, you know what I'm saying?
It's the amount of time that he spends on it that to me, and I'm sure, you know, sooner or later we have to address this whole like dream logic, because that's the thing that everyone kind of throws around when you talk about a lot of Italian horror, in particular Fulci, and especially in particular The Beyond. But like, there is something that's genuinely nightmarish in that it reflects having a nightmare in those scenes where it's like, this is repellent, this is upsetting. Why won't this stop? Like, it won't, it doesn't let up. It won't, he won't let you go. You just kind of have to sit there and bear witness to this awful thing that just keeps going.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's so, that's the other thing too, that I think is really fascinating with him, is there's so many directors where they're like, oh, less is more, which I don't really agree with. I think, like, you know, obviously with something like Jaws, that's certainly the case. But there's a lot of other movies where you're like, why aren't you seeing that? Like, you should see that because you get an effect out of it. And it almost feels like it's like an excuse sometimes. But with him, he doesn't shy away from anything. He makes some incredibly bold decisions, you know, where it goes kind of like Stuart Gordon in this way, where it's like pushing things to the edge and then it goes over the edge and then it keeps going like past that, where you're like, oh, this guy just like smashed his head open, and you're like, oh, now the spiders are coming. Oh, and now they're like eating his face, you know? And it's like, you're just keep thinking, you're like, oh, it's going to stop right here. And it keeps going. I want to make a really quick aside about him too, because I actually just watched it. This kind of relates to what we were talking about, but I watched this TV movie he did called Sweet House of Horrors. Which is pretty obscure, but the opening of this movie is like this couple comes back home and they end up getting, like, they find this guy who was like trying to rob their house. So the guy goes and attacks them and like brutally murders them. And he like grabs the husband, caves his head in on the back of this, or on like the corner of this fireplace, like this like sharp edge of it, and does it like 30 times, you know, to just this ridiculous degree. And then he goes and grabs the wife, burns her face on the stove, and then like strangles her and like does all this horrible stuff. And this was like his idea of a toned down TV movie. It is as violent as The Beyond. It's insane. And basically when they saw it, they were like, we're not airing this. You're out of your mind. And it ended up getting released to, I think, direct to video over there. But it's fascinating just that he had that level of consistency with his stuff over the years.
And what do you suppose it is like that kind of, because, you know, for a long time, his movies aren't doing that. And then it's like a switch gets flipped around zombie, right?
Yeah.
Is it a commercial decision at first because he sees like, well, oh, zombie is successful?
No, because I mean, like, Don't Torture a Duckling, they have, you know, there's a sequence toward the end of that movie where someone gets thrown off a cliff.
Yeah.
The guy's face is getting like ripped apart as it's like hitting the rocks below.
Right, right.
I mean, and you're just like, it's, I mean, I think it had been present for a while. It's just the thing with him that's fascinating is that he took such a weird left turn from going to like, you know, the senator likes women and, you know, these other, and some of the Westerns, I think, with Franco Nero and, I mean, like Massacre Time. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's some incredibly violent stuff in that movie. And same with For the Apocalypse. I mean, they're almost like kind of precursors to that. So, I mean, I feel like it's been pretty prominent through a lot of his work. But yeah, I mean, I think Zombie is when he started really, really going for it.
Yeah. So recently I saw The Beyond, as I know you did. You saw it out in LA and I saw it here in Chicago, screened with a live accompaniment by Fritzy Tufolci. So they have the band playing the score live on stage, and it was like, you and I haven't talked about it, but it was cool, right?
Oh yeah, I thought it was amazing.
It was like,
I mean, like how are you not gonna enjoy? I mean, maybe if you've like never seen the movie or something before and don't like cool things, I guess you might have a bad time there. But I thought it was absolutely amazing. I mean, like, that was one of those things. So, like, when I was sitting in the audience, I'm like, I can't believe I'm actually witnessing this.
Yeah.
That because you just don't. It's like when you start watching these movies when you're teens, you don't ever think there's an option of like, oh, I'm going to someday see this on like a huge screen at the Egyptian in Hollywood with like the guy who composed the music playing it live with like a full band. You know, it's like, it's such a cool thing.
It was such a cool way to see the movie. And for the first couple minutes, I think I was a little bit distracted just because it was like, it was just a different experience, you know. It wasn't just the traditional kind of movie going experience, just having people kind of moving around down front and having their music stand lights on and stuff like that. And then at a certain point, I didn't tune it out because I was still very much listening to the music, but I was no longer distracted by it. And I was so hyper focused on the movie for whatever reason, having the band play live, like almost made me tune into everything on a wavelength that I never had before. Maybe it was just that I was paying particular attention to the way that the sound matched up with the images, or because the volume was so cranked up that I heard all the crazy, just like ADR footsteps that are throughout that entire movie. But like, it was the best I'd ever seen the movie. And maybe it was because it was the first time I'd ever seen it screened theatrically. I'd only ever watched it at home, but that experience made me love The Beyond even more than I already did.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating too to see like a rescore of it. Although, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I didn't notice that. I mean, I noticed a few spots where it was different, but it wasn't so different where
right.
It's like, sometimes you see someone like redo their old work. Like, you know, you can watch like the Donnie Darko director's cut and you're like, geez, this is terrible, you know. And with this, it all just really fit well together. You know, I mean, it was like the stuff he kind of tweaked. It felt like a natural fit to it. So, you know, I mean, it might be cool. Maybe down the line, they'll do another Blu-ray where they'll have his rescore on it or something.
And I was seeing the movie with my wife, who has never seen it, who has never seen a Fulci movie, who has never seen an Italian horror movie. And I said,
"Oh my God."
Well, I dragged her to it with me because I was like, listen, you're not really going to be into this, but but it's a cool way to see a movie. You know, like the experience I knew would be cool even if the movie made no sense to her. And she has a pretty low threshold for violence, so I was trying to like give her the heads up and be like, okay, look away. And I think I got most of them. And she did. She enjoyed the experience. But I know on the drive home, she was kind of asking some questions about the story. And I felt terrible because I was like, yeah, I don't totally know. And she's like, but don't you love this movie? I was like, yeah, but that doesn't mean I understand all of it in terms of like a narrative. But that's not really what the movie's after, right?
I mean, you know, I actually had this argument with someone kind of recently because they were like, you can't explain that movie at all. And I was like, well, I mean, the movie's basically there's this warlock who is killed by these townspeople and his ghost ends up haunting this hotel that, right. You know, they build over his grave. And it happens to be on like one of the seven gateways to hell. And I mean, I think a lot of the time people are very sort of like hard on the narrative because there's like a lot of like weird things in it, you know, like they have like the guy like painting the house who like falls off the ladder and they're just, there feels like there's all these like sort of like quick, like little random offshoots. But,
right.
You know, I mean, I don't feel like, I feel like there's such depth in a lot of what he's doing in it that, you know, it doesn't bother me that I don't really like saying the word or saying dream logic
right.
with it, but just that it's, you know, somewhat of an obtuse path to get to the ending of the movie. It doesn't really bother me. It certainly, you know, breaks some of the three act structure, but I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's part of what makes it really interesting. And, you know, has people still watching it 30 years later.
Which I totally agree with. I sometimes have a hard time explaining that to someone who maybe isn't on that wavelength, which was me a couple years ago. You know, if somebody was like, oh, I love this, I'd be like, wow, why? And now all of a sudden I'm on the other side of it where I'm like, yep, I'm totally willing to just let it wash over me and to experience the things that he wants me to experience. The specific things that she was asking questions about were like mostly in regards to the Emily character and some of the things that she says in the scene, you know, I did what you wanted. I did. And I was like, I don't know that I can like fully explain her entire character.
I mean, to me, it seems like they, you know, I mean, this might just be my interpretation of it, but with her, it seems like, you know, she was in a similar situation to how we see them at the end of the movie
right.
where they go in. And she's also, too, she's in the very beginning of the movie, which a lot of people miss that. Like, she's in that flashback sequence before her eyes have gone over. So, I mean, she's essentially from another time. But she goes into this and she says, I did what you wanted me to do. And I think it's like that sort of world or dimension or whatever sort of like – toying with her in a way to get, you know, more people lured in,
right,
or to have her almost like guide them in an odd way. But you know, I mean, it's also too, I think it's really interesting that we can have a conversation about this and like maybe come up with some different interpretations for who Emily is. And like, that's the stuff I love in horror movies, is where everything's not just spoon fed to you. Like I probably shouldn't talk smack on this movie, but I'm going to. I went and watched Lights Out, and it's just like they reveal absolutely everything. And you're like, here's where the monster came from.
Right.
Here's her connection to their mom. Da, da, da. And you're like, this is so not scary now. You're just like, this is her friend with a skin condition. And it just like completely loses all effect as soon as they're just like reveal like, oh, this was really sad, you know, like she had a tragic past, and you're like, okay, well, I'm definitely not scared of her now, and or whatever the creature was. And it just, you know, the fact that like Fulci left a little bit up to the imagination of the viewer. And I think it was, did Sergio Stivaletti write it?
That is no.
They're not Stivaletti. He's the effects guy. It was Dardano Sacchetti.
Yes. Yeah.
That was who I met. So yeah, he wrote it, which, you know, he was like one of Fulci's great collaborators. So and it's interesting too to see kind of the drop off with his movies after they stopped working together, because he I think he like quit on, I can't remember what his last one was, but there's, I think maybe it was like Conquest or something, I'm not sure, but I mean they did like Manhattan Baby together, they did New York Ripper, they did Gates of Hell, they did Zombie, you know, there's quite a few of them. And House by the Cemetery also. So, I mean, it's like most of Fulci's great films came from his collaboration with this guy.
Yeah.
But I don't know. That was a pretty big tangent.
No, that's okay. The example that I always use for that phenomenon that you're talking about is the American remake of The Ring, which I know a lot of people love. But, like, I remember seeing it the first time, and they watched the video, and I was like, well, that's really unsettling, and like I couldn't even tell you why, because it's just a horse and a woman brushing her hair, and it's just all these images, and yet for some reason put back to back like that, I was like, well, oh, that is genuinely creepy. And then they spend the rest of the movie saying, oh, well, here's who the lady was brushing her hair, and here's why the horse is in it, and here's this image, and here's this image, and all of a sudden it kind of robbed it of any of its power. It was just this thing that was easily explainable. And it made it less scary to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you on that. I think the American one is really quite good. I do agree with it, explaining it, that it undermines it a little bit, but I think Gore Verbinski is he's like such a monumental talent that he can kind of get away with it. But yeah, I mean, it's like generally I don't really care about where Leatherface came from, or, you know, if
he had a skin condition and his nose fell off.
Yeah,
and
like
blah,
when,
blah.
Dude, oh God. When I saw that in the remake, I was like, fuck this movie.
And that seems to be the guiding principle behind remaking a lot of stuff, is like, well, what can we explain that hasn't been explained, as though that's what made us love the original films, is like wanting to know Leatherface's origin, you know?
Yeah, it's also too, that, what was the other one I was just gonna mention? I mean, I think with like Michael Myers, it's like the more they kind of like get into his backstory, the less and less interesting he is, you know? Because they keep trying to like, over the course of those movies, they keep sort of like trying to go back to the first one, but to explain a little bit more of it. And it's just like each time they do it, you're just like, I don't know. Like, it's like he's going after his family now, or like, who cares? It's not, it's like, I don't feel like any of us are really watching it because we have a huge affinity for Laurie Strode. I think she's a totally serviceable character, and, you know, she's relatable, but it's not like, you know, she's not like, I'm trying to think of like a really, she's not like, you know, like Mike and Jody and Reggie and Phantasm, where you're like completely on their side. You're just like, I love them, I want to watch them be in every movie. You know, it's like with her, I think she's a little plain, but, you know, we can kind of step into her shoes. So, I mean, I think all this, I'm going off on a huge tangent, but into all the backstory of, those characters can be very detrimental toward the movie.
And so I guess to bring it back to The Beyond, as you had said, like that's one of the things that does kind of make it I don't know if that's what makes it rewatchable so much as it is kind of the cumulative effect. But each time I revisit it, I don't find myself being frustrated by the lack of answers. It's one of those things where I'm just like, yeah, you know, I don't, it doesn't totally matter. Cause yeah, I get the broad strokes. I get, you know, there's a hotel bit built, over hell. I get that, Emily, you know, is from that dimension. Although I will admit, I have never noticed her in that prologue. You saying that is the first time.
No one ever does, because she has such like a grand entrance in the, you know, around the 35 minute mark or whatever in the movie. Or maybe a little bit before that, where she's on that highway with Dickie, her amazing attack dog. And you know, you get such a mind blowing intro for a character where she's just standing in the middle of this totally empty highway as the car drives up to her. She's, you know, got the white eyeballs standing there with her dog. It's like, it's such a stark image, but you know, she is in the beginning of that movie. And, you know, I think it's like in the, I can't remember what, when it feel like it's like early 1900s for the very start of it.
Yeah. But
it's just, it's one of those things like people miss in there. And, you know, I mean, I think it's safe to say he did that intentionally. You know, it's like, I don't think he accidentally put her in the beginning of that movie. And so he obviously had an idea about where she came from and her history, and so did the writer. You know, so I mean, it's also too, when this stuff gets translated into other languages, it's not, you know, Fulci and Sacchetti aren't the guys doing it. It's like someone else is interpreting what they said, and it's going to come through their voice in a way. And a lot of times that ends up being really wonderful, because you get all these sort of bizarro, you know, Italian dubs from it. But it's also too, it's like really the only true way to watch that movie is to learn Italian and watch it in the original language track. And I'm sure within that, you're probably going to have kind of a different experience with the movie.
But for the most part in this one, the actors are speaking English, yes? I mean, it's dubbed, well, like their voices are dubbed, but even their original dialogue was delivered in English, I think.
I mean, it definitely is for some of the leads, but it, you know, a lot of those movies are made with Italian actors.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It's also, I think, I can't remember what I was going to say about that, but I mean, that's a completely fair point, but there is a lot of that stuff where when they're recording it, they kind of rewrite the movie in post. It's,
yes,
like it was a very common thing,
right,
in an Italian film, because essentially like they wouldn't really record dialogue on set on a lot of those movies.
Right.
Like there's sort of a famous Jessica Harper story about Suspiria where she said she, you know, like went into the ballet school for her entrance into that. And she said all the other actresses were just talking in like nonsense language, like they're just sounded like complete lunatics, and they were all screaming over each other. She said it was one of the most jarring things she'd ever seen, because they weren't actually saying, they weren't speaking in any real language. They were,
right,
just having stuff for their mouths to, you know, be matched up with later on, which is pretty interesting. But I don't know, I've just always had that in the back of my head with this movie.
And there's, you know, with a lot of Italian horror, there's like, it's almost two steps removed, because as you had said, like it's translated from the original Italian into English, and then it's kind of dubbed by another actor on top of that. And that's one of the things that I end up loving about a lot of these movies, is just the weird effect of that. And again, not to invoke this idea of dream logic or whatever, because again, I do think that's kind of a shortcut when something can't be explained, but there is like this weird otherness to the whole thing that just adds to the overall effect of it, that if you're into this kind of a thing, like that's part of the charm, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just one of these things where, because of the way they were kind of, what they were intending for those movies to be, and, you know, all the circumstances around it, you end up getting something kind of magical that I feel like is very hard to recreate now, because people are a little too conscious of it. And part of the reason why I think we just have so few of these, you know, movies where, I mean, I'm trying to think of like a good recent example, even though I don't think this is a good movie, but, you know, something like The Room, where you can watch and it's incredibly entertaining for the wrong reasons. I almost feel like it's a lot harder to pull that off now because people are so sort of like tuned into irony and a lot of these other things because of the cultural zeitgeist. And it's like, right, as soon as someone kind of cracks whatever is going on in the movie, everyone knows about it. And it's like, there's not a lot of space to kind of like deliberate on some of these things. I don't know if I'm getting like too far off course here, but no. But I mean, with like Fulci's stuff, it's like it was done in like a certain time and place, and, you know, with like a certain attitude and aesthetic that you kind of can't really recreate now. And it's also too, so much of that just came from who he was as a person, that if someone tried to do it, it still wouldn't feel like him because they have their own sort of identity that they're bringing into the project. So, I don't know. That's my thought on the matter.
Yeah. So this is off topic from the beyond, but I'm trying to make this analogy, and I think it's probably a bullshit analogy, so I apologize.
Go for it.
Because I'm always trying to figure out like the things that, you know, there are specific things that I'm very drawn to in horror, right? So if you put down Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street in front of me, I'm going to choose a Nightmare on Elm Street. And that's not to say that Halloween's not brilliant, and that's not to say that it's not a masterpiece, and that's not to say that it's not a perfectly constructed movie, right? Uh-huh. It's just that that is, to me, more what it is. And Nightmare on Elm Street, while it has rougher edges, has all these things that I respond to much more, right? So there's this constant, you know, Fulci versus Argento kind of, not a debate, because obviously you can love both. I love a ton of Argento films. And so I'm not saying like one has to be better than the other, but if you pit the two of them side by side, I'm just trying to think about like what it is that I respond to in Fulci, because Argento is such a technician that to me he's Halloween. And Fulci is a Nightmare on Elm Street, where it's the edges are rougher, but there's a different sort of imagination at work. It requires a different sort of investment from the viewer. Is any of this making sense?
Yeah, totally.
All right. Because I'm just trying to figure out what it is in the beyond that I respond to, because I've never quite tried to articulate it before. You know, like I've seen it and I've loved it, but I've never really... And part of it is because I don't really have anyone in my day-to-day life that is into Italian horror like I am. So I don't have anybody to talk about it with. So now I'm excited to be talking about it with you, but realizing that I've never really tried to kind of parse out what it is that I love about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's honestly too, it's just because of like their culture. There's an interesting thing. 'Cause I remember catching this a few years ago, and a lot of it has to do with them trying to remake. I mean, not Argento doesn't really do this, but a lot of it is like they're trying to emulate their heroes in a sense, where Argento is trying to emulate Hitchcock, right, but it's, you know, coming out in this sort of like nutty surrealist way. And a lot of it just comes from their interpretations of like what American life is like, and because they're so far off base a lot of the time, it ends up being like weirdly brilliant,
right?
This isn't an Argento or Fulci movie, but there's this movie called Cannibal Apocalypse, which I'm spacing who directed it right now, but John Saxon and Giovanni Ribisi are in it.
Yeah.
And there's a scene in it where there's like a couple making out at the front of a movie theater, but they're completely naked and having sex. And so you're basically like, oh, that's their idea of like what a couple making out in the movie theater is they're at the front of the theater, completely naked, having sex with each other. And so you're like, it's almost there, but it's so far off that it just becomes genius. So I think a lot of those films have that quality, which I really respond to just because it's I like seeing stuff that's kind of unique and has its own voice. And that's yeah, that's my feeling on it.
That is Antonio Margheriti.
Yes, that's right. I couldn't remember who. I just totally spaced it. I have the soundtrack by oh god, I can't remember his name. It's like Alessandro something.
Alexander Blanksteiner.
Yeah, Blankstein or Blanksteiner.
This is I'm just looking at Wikipedia. I don't know these things.
Yeah, it's Blanksteiner. The soundtrack is utterly brilliant. I highly recommend it.
I don't think I've ever seen a Margheriti movie.
He's cool. You know, I think he did 2019. Or wait, no, did he do 2019 After the Fall of New York, or was that
no.
Sergio? That was Sergio Martino. Sorry.
Yeah.
Margheriti, I think. Who did Torso? I'm trying to remember.
That's Martino.
Yeah. Well, I love Martino, but Margheriti, I haven't seen as much of his.
Seven Deaths in a Cat's Eye, I haven't seen. That's him. I'm just trying to look through some of his filmography here. And You're the Hunter from the Future, I have not seen.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly remember. I've seen that show up in a lot of places, but I haven't watched that one either.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there is an interesting thing between them where there was obviously a rivalry between those guys, and it's kind of fascinating because Argento produced The Wax Mask, which was supposed to be Fulci's comeback film before his untimely demise.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting to see that with that these guys had, you know, sort of their own camps where they were like feuding within the same small industry. It's fascinating. I've never really been more I've never like felt like I had to pick one or the other. I think they're both brilliant in their own ways. But Fulci's stuff I find myself maybe watching a little bit more, with the exception of Tenebrae. I've seen that movie quite a few times, but I feel like Fulci's stuff is a little more rewatchable. But it's a really, they're both just both guys are totally brilliant, you know.
Yeah. So the back to the Beyond, like, what is it about this movie that makes it his best? In a lot of ways, I feel it's his most ambitious film, depending on how you sort of define ambition, because I think in some ways, like, Cat in the Brain is his most ambitious, but also, you know, one of the craziest, but also kind of fascinating too, in terms of what we're talking about and the things that he was interested in or some of his obsessions. Cat in the Brain almost helps focus some of those things. Like, I don't know how often I can watch that movie. But I think it's fascinating, you know, as kind of this weird experimental sort of autobiographical weird statement from an artist. But yeah, for me, it's in the Beyond. I mean, I really like Gates of Hell. And it's a really kind of almost relentlessly nasty movie. And I think the Beyond isn't as much. I think the Beyond kind of picks and chooses its moments a little bit more.
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, I think Gates of Hell is like, oh god, like, it's like, honestly, it's really hard
dark.
To watch.
Yeah. It's fucking dark. And I saw a revival screening of it a couple months ago, and it was very strange because it was a full crowd, which was really cool. But again, there's that thing where, and I don't know how much of this you guys get out in LA, but like, there was some of that ironic laughter throughout, because and I mean, sometimes I know you can't help it because there is a weird line of dubbing, or, you know, the way that the guy falls off the ladder at the start of the Beyond, it does come out of nowhere. And it's like our reaction is to laugh. But I couldn't understand why an audience full of people would come out to see Gates of Hell and then kind of, ha ha ha, isn't it funny, the dubbing. especially because I think they were there, you know, as fans, but that's beside the point. But yeah, seeing it that way, it is so, it's really dark.
Like, yeah.
It's a really dark movie.
I'm with you. I think Gates of Hell is like one of his nastiest movies, for sure. But yeah, I don't know what so there is some of that. It depends where the venue is a lot of the time for like why people are like laughing or heckling the movie, which is always just very frustrating. It's super annoying. If you do that, fuck you, and don't go see movies theatrically. If you, for anyone who heckles the movie, you suck, you're not funny, and everyone hates you. I think laughing at random stuff here and there, I think is, it's like, you can't help it. Sometimes like something is just super funny.
But, right.
Anyone heckling or texting is horrible and just needs to stay in their living room.
It seems to happen more, at least in my experience, a lot of times for older movies too, that I don't see a lot of newer movies and hear people heckling or laughing ironically, but when I go see old things, and sometimes it's, I think, about the conditions under which you're seeing it. Sometimes it is, you know, one of these day-long festivals or a 24-hour thing where people are like, well, this is, you know, a non-traditional way to see a movie, so I'm going to behave non-traditionally and whatever. But sometimes I think it is just like, this is old and therefore funny, which strikes me as very odd, but whatever.
I can't wrap my head around like why you would go and pay to see one of those movies in the theater if like you think it sucks or it's stupid. Like you know, you can certainly watch it at home and have that opinion, and that's up to you. But it's just, it seems very selfish and just weird, where it's like you realize you're watching this with a lot of other people that probably want to see it. And right. I don't know. I mean, that honestly feels like much more of a recent phenomenon, with going to like repertory movies, because it generally hasn't really been that way. You know, I've lived in Los Angeles for like 10 years, and generally it's been pretty respectful, but it sort of depends on what the movie is and, you know, what the crowd is and all of that stuff. I don't know. I blame the internet.
You might not be wrong. Do you have a favorite sequence in The Beyond?
I mean, absolutely the ending of it, I think,
yeah,
is amazing. It's like, it's one of the most perfect endings I've seen in a movie before, and very much something I was hoping to emulate at the end of Beyond the Gates. But I just think it would have been really fascinating to see if Fulci had been able to do his sequel to it, which was called Beyond the Beyond.
It's the greatest title for a movie ever.
I know, it really is. But it, you know, I think, and it was pretty much the whole thing was supposed to take place in there. It would have been very interesting. But yeah, the very ending of it is my favorite. I love the girl getting her head blown off.
Yeah.
I think all the Emily stuff is very entertaining. And I mean, it's obviously like, look, it's funny when she's, you know, saying like, attack, Dickie, attack, like over and over again. It's like, you're going to laugh at that, but I don't think you need to. I don't think anyone needs to like be making their own commentary over that.
Right. And again, no matter how many times I see it, I'm not surprised when the dog turns on her anymore, because I know that it's coming. And yet, there is a weird sort of, it's not that it's punishing you, but you know, we like Emily. And to have that happen to her, it's, you know, a lot of the horror movies I watch, it's like, well, this is fun. And, you know, Friday the 13th, even when a character dies, it's like, haha, this is, not to say that I'm like laughing at it ironically, but it's just, it's, we watch it because it's a good time. And in that moment, I mean, it's horrifying in a way that is genuinely horrifying. Here's a character that we like, who we cared about, who we don't expect to die, especially at this moment, and especially not this way, right? Her faithful companion turning on her, and it's brutal, again, the way that it's shot. it's so jarring no matter how many times see it.
Well, you know what was crazy was when we were watching it at the Egyptian, that sequence came up. And I mean, I've probably watched the movie 24 times at this point, but when Dickie like goes and tears out her jugular, I totally jumped. And I've been like, I know that's coming. I know the exact timing of it. And it's still just the sound hit me in the right way. And I got startled by it. So, you know, I think you're clearly doing something right if you can pull that off.
I also hadn't noticed, I find the spider sequence very entertaining, and did almost kind of laugh at the screening where they were playing live, only because they had to essentially restart the music cue because it goes on for so long that it's like, oh, we better start over. And I don't think I'd ever noticed, and maybe I just wasn't paying close enough attention, but until it was on this giant screen, the effect of like the spiders that are in the background, like the ones that you don't quite see in the foreground. It's essentially there with like a rubber spider trying to rock it back and forth.
Yeah, where they're like their limbs aren't moving independently of one another. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And again, none of that stuff bothers me because once you're kind of on board for something, it all becomes part of the aesthetic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's honestly, once you settle into it, I think you're on the movie's side, you know, or you should be anyway. It's just, I don't quite know how to put it, but it's like, you just see, you can kind of see the edges of some of these things. And to me, I'm not really bothered by them, you know, because like once I invest in it and it's like, you know, I mean, he is treating the audience with respect. You know, he's like not playing down to anyone. And even though it's like whatever, he probably didn't have the money to get like 12 real trained spiders. But it's like that doesn't mean the sequence is any less effective.
Right. Why is the eyeball sequence in Zombie so legendary and the second eyeball sequence in The Beyond not as famous?
It's so like, you know, it is funny you mentioned that, because when we were watching that at the Egyptian, I had that same thought where I was like, God, I actually forgot there was her horrible eyeball death in it. It's just, there's something very primal that Zombie taps into with splinters, because we've all had a splinter at some point in our life.
Yeah.
And this thing is driving straight toward her eyeball for such a drawn out period of time that you can't help but be like, oh no, don't. And like, it's one of those things where it's like you hit, like you knock the corner of a table or something, or like bump your knee into it. And so when you see someone get their like head smashed into a corner, you're like, oh God. 'Cause like you can associate it with something. And I feel like with The Beyond, I can't quite remember what it, I know like her eyeball gets pulled out, and I can't remember exactly like what instrument they use on it.
He pushes her head onto a nail, and so the eye comes out from the back, basically.
That's right. Yeah, it's like it goes all the way through her head. It's just, we don't have, I feel like we just don't have a real frame of reference for that, where, you know, it's like you see, if you saw in a movie where someone got like a paper cut in between the webbing of their fingers, you'd be like, ugh, you know, even though that's not as grotesque or horrific as, you know, someone getting their eyeball pushed out through the back of their head. It's just, there's a closer association with it that we can all relate to.
And Fulci does something really interesting. He does it with the eyeball gag in Zombie. He does it again with the drill in City of the Living Dead, where I don't know if it's because like we've been trained, maybe, you know, I grew up watching American movies or Hollywood movies or whatever, where if something is drawn out like that, it's James Bond, you know, being lowered into whatever, a pit of alligators, or somebody being, you know, going down a sawmill and they're getting closer to the blade. And like, we've been trained, if it's drawn out like that, it means that the character is being given time to escape, essentially, you know. So the longer it's drawn out, the more comfortable we feel that, like, okay, well, this isn't going to happen. And what Fulci does in both movies is draws it out until you're like, okay, so this isn't going to happen. Then all of a sudden, wham, oh shit, no, the drill still went into his head. I thought for sure they were going to back away. And same with the eyeball. It's sort of that extended anticipation that's almost being used against us.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing too, when people just say he's like a clunky director, it's like he clearly was very deliberate about his choices, you know, because the directors I feel like are clunky. You don't get any sense of consistency with their stuff, you know, or like there's no real reasoning behind it. Like I think kind of the greatest sin you can have in like a director's filmography is like if you can watch a movie and you have no idea who directed it, like, or like you can watch a series of their stuff and be like, God, that didn't really feel like that, or like, oh, that guy directed this, like that's weird, you know. It's like there needs to be some kind of through line or signature across those movies, or a sense of authorship.
Do you kind of watch movies that way? I mean, I feel like I do. Like, I try to look for those things, those kind of touches that come from a specific filmmaker. And sometimes that will even draw me to a movie that I might not otherwise love. You know, I'm such a Tobe Hooper fan that, like, I'll watch The Mangler and I'll like it because it's such a crazy Tobe Hooper movie. But I recognize that, like, as a movie, maybe it's not that great. But because I'm watching it through, like you said, that sense of authorship, I respond to it. Do you kind of watch movies that way?
Yeah. I mean, well, to an extent, it's more like, you know, as I kept, there's a lot of, basically, like, what I would do is, well, if I found a director I liked, I would try to watch everything that they've ever done.
Right.
So, you know, it was kind of a good way to get educated on a lot of, you know, kind of interesting people. Like Curtis Hanson was certainly one where, you know, I watched LA Confidential and I was like, holy shit, this guy's amazing. I want to see everything he did up to this point. And it's interesting because you start seeing how their career kind of forms over time and, you know, where they carry over things and that type of thing. It's funny you mentioned Tobe Hooper, though, because he has one of the most puzzling career trajectories out of anyone I've ever seen, because Texas Chainsaw Massacre is like an absolutely perfect horror movie. The first time I watched that, I was like, this is my favorite horror movie of all time. It was just so intense and disturbing. And, you know, I saw it on like an 18-inch TV screen and I was like, holy shit, I cannot believe how much this movie is fucking with me. And, you know, and you watch Eaten Alive right after that, which feels like it came from the same guy. And then at a certain point, it's like he was still making good movies. But the fact that he directed Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, they feel like they could not be like, they don't feel like those are made by the same guy. You're like, this is like someone else's crazy, like, comedy version of this. You're like, I can't believe this is the same dude who made this movie. And I like the sequel, but it's just such an odd thing to see that, where you're like, Michael Winner, as a quick aside, is kind of like that too, where like if you watch Death Wish 1, 2, and 3, all three of those feel like they're made by completely different people. And you're like, this is the guy who made the original. Why is this so different? It's so weird. But yeah, I mean, I certainly do watch it in a similar fashion, yeah. You know?
Since you mentioned like Texas Chainsaw for a time maybe being your favorite horror movie, do you have a favorite horror movie?
You know, I mean, I've kind of gone back and forth. I think probably Phantasm. You know, I think there's just a lot to take in that movie, and I do think it's a little rough around the edges, but in a way that really works for me on you know, a few different levels. I think there's so much imagination in that movie, and the fact that, you know, he made that when he was like 20 years old, yeah, is just unbelievable. It's like there's so many people where you're like, God, this would be like their something they'd make, you know, in their 40s or something. You know, I mean, that is, I mean, probably Phantasm, honestly. It's like, it's the one I just keep coming back to over and over. Chainsaw is definitely a very close second. But yeah, I mean, those are kind of the two, I think.
And was The Beyond at all a conscious influence on Beyond the Gates? I'm not even positive. I mean, is the title a direct reference, or is it just you liked the word?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, we quite literally, we've mashed it up from The Beyond and the Gates
right.
of Hell.
Which is kind of what I figured, but...
Yeah, it was absolutely, because it just always stuck in my mind because of the ending mainly was like the big thing we were kind of pulling from it. I mean, there's a few, once people see the movie, there's like a few little sort of, I don't want to say references, but you know, there's some influence from that
right,
movie that we
right.
carried over. But yeah, I mean, it absolutely was a one of our main influences on it.
And if there ever is a sequel to Beyond the Gates, will it be called Beyond the Gates?
It will be called From Beyond the Gates. And then if we do a third one, we're calling it Return from Beyond the Gates.
I could not be more excited about the possibility of a third Beyond the Gates.
Yeah, I think it'll be, I mean, if all goes to plan, it should be pretty cool. But we have, there's some interest in the sequel right now, which I'm hoping we can do. And I think I told you about this before, but it would be Chase Williamson's character, John, would be the protagonist in it. And he'd have a new girlfriend, and they'd be playing a more advanced version of the game for reasons I will keep quiet, but it should be cool, you know. Hopefully this one will do well and we'll get to do a follow-up.
I will do everything in my power to make sure that that this one does well. I will beat the drum loud and proud, because I am such a fan of it. And I don't know, you don't know yet if it will play in Chicago at all, right?
I'm hoping so. I think there's a pretty good chance for it. It's definitely going to be in New York and LA, and then the other three cities I kind of have to talk to them about. And but we'll know soon enough.
All right. Well, if there's anything I can do in Chicago, if you need somebody to host anything or whatever, I'm your man.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I will let you go, because I've kept you long enough. But I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, man. Anytime you want me back on, I'm happy to pop in.
That would be awesome. I'll just remind everyone that Beyond the Gates is fucking awesome, and will be out December 9th. Yes?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Theatrically. See it theatrically if you can, if it's playing near you. It's a movie that should be seen in theaters and also on VOD. Thank you so much for talking about The Beyond, Jackson Stewart.
You're very welcome, Patrick. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks, guys.
Listening to FS Movie.